Okay. We're ready to go here. The last several sermons, I've been talking about the covenants. And so this will be my third sermon where we'll be discussing the covenants. So let's take a quick review of where we are, where we've been, and then we'll talk about where we're going today. I did start out with the what we don't usually think of so much as a covenant, but it was. It was an agreement between Adam and Eve and God, which I refer to here as the Adamic covenant. We talked about that. We talked about the Noachian covenant, which was an unconditional covenant, that God wouldn't destroy the earth again like he did at the flood. And then we went into the Abrahamic covenant, which is really the big one. Because everything from that point forward really flowed from the promises that God made to Abraham. And so, and he made a lot of promises. First, they were conditional. Then, as God's relationship with Abraham increased, they eventually became unconditional. But they promised his descendants would be as the sand of the sea and as number of stars in the sky. That means his descendants would virtually fill the whole world. A great nation and a company of nations was part of that, which we believe Ephraim and Manasseh fulfilled by the United States and the British Commonwealth. And other promises of the Messiah, it was pointed to in that covenant, and eventually confirmed that it would be through Abraham that the Messiah would come. And then we looked at some specific parts that relate to it. Everything really flows back to that Abrahamic covenant. We looked at the Judaic covenant, in which as Abraham, his son Isaac's son Jacob, those same promises were passed on to each of them, and even enlarged more. So when Jacob blessed his sons, he blessed Judah and said that the scepter would flow through Judah and his descendants, and that they would be the law keepers and preserve God's law. And then we moved on to the Mosaic, or the Old Testament, Old Covenant, and looked at that, and of course that was an agreement, and it's unique in history. It's the only time that God has made a special agreement with a nation. And, you know, what a blessing it is if you can make a covenant with God himself. They had that opportunity. They didn't take advantage of it. It was kind of an up and down thing, and eventually part of that covenant, it was conditional. As long as they obeyed, they would be blessed. Several chapters in the Old Testament, Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28. We call them the blessings and cursings chapters because they explain what the blessings will be, but what the cursings will be also. And the nation of ancient Israel ended up experiencing, in certain times, many of the blessings, but more often the cursings of lack of obedience. And then we looked at what I call the Ezraic covenant, which was a renewal of that old covenant between the exiles who came back to Israel from Babylon and rebuilt the temple under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah. And the governor that was made the governor of that district when the Persians allowed them to come back, Zerubbabel. And so that was a covenant which probably God honored, so because it was made, initiated by the people to renew that old covenant relationship. And God probably would have honored it since it went through his priest and his prophets. But then that didn't last long. And they fell away and fell back into disobedience. And so that's where we stopped last time. And so I want to continue on with the covenants. I want to talk about, first of all, get into one that was, I might say, a sub-covenant of the Old Covenant, the Mosaic Covenant, and that is the Sabbath Covenant. So we'll start out today talking about the Sabbath Covenant. You know the story of God appearing on Sinai and giving the Ten Commandments and the law, and then filling in with Moses when the children of Israel said, "No, we can't take it. We don't want to hear God's direct voice. You go up, you talk to him, then come back and tell us what he said." And of course, the Sabbath is one of the commandments. But God went further than that with this particular commandment and made it a covenant, as we see in Exodus 31, beginning in verse 12. Exodus 31, verse 12. "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak also to the children of Israel, saying, Surely my Sabbath," notice the plural there of Sabbath, "you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. You shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death. For whoever does work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people." That's pretty strong words. "You don't keep the Sabbath, we kill you." That was the law in ancient Israel. But it was a covenant within the Old Covenant. And we know that the Sabbath goes all the way back to Adam and Eve, so this wasn't a new thing. Abraham surely kept the Sabbath. And so you could say, well, it goes back to Abraham and his relationship with God. But he goes on here in we'll go to verse 16. "Therefore," of Exodus 31, "therefore the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant." It's a perpetual covenant. It just wasn't a covenant for that nation. It was a perpetual covenant. "It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed." And so it extends basically as long as the Abrahamic covenant extends, which is basically forever. And so that was a separate, but a part of the Old Covenant, but it was a separate covenant. It's an identifying sign. It identifies the children of Israel, those who keep that Sabbath, the seventh-day Sabbath. If we look over in the New Testament, we know that it is perpetual because Christ kept it long after the nation of Israel was dead and buried. Luke 4, verses 14 through 16, "Then Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee, and news of him went out through all the surrounding region, and he taught in their synagogues, being glorified by all. So he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and as his custom was," and it was his custom to keep the Sabbath, "he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. And he was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written." And he turned to Isaiah to make a quote from the passage in Isaiah. But we look here and we see that Christ was still keeping the Sabbath when he came. And if we, rather than reading the rest of this quote from Luke, let's go back to Isaiah and see what he quoted here in Isaiah. It's in Isaiah 61, verses 1 and 2. "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." So obviously Christ is pointing back to this because this was a prophecy of Christ and what he would do with his first coming. And then Isaiah goes on to also talk about Christ's second coming, but this part particularly related to his first coming. And we know that the Sabbath will continue to be kept in Isaiah 66, verses 22 and 23. For as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make, shall remain before me, says the Lord, so shall your descendants and your name remain. And it shall be, and it shall come to pass, that from one new moon to another, and from one Sabbath to another, all flesh shall come and worship before me, says the Lord. So the Sabbath will still be kept in the millennium. All the way to the new heavens and new earth, the Sabbath will still be kept. So the Sabbath will be in effect in the millennium and on thereafter. But something happened. Something happened from most of the first century. Those Christians who were called out kept the seventh-day Sabbath. By around 90 A.D., we think that was probably about the last apostle, the longest living apostle was probably John. We know he lived up to around 90 A.D. or so when he recorded the book of Revelation. So that first century, the Church of God was a seventh-day Sabbath-keeping church. But then something happened. And, you know, deceivers came into the church. They began to change the doctrines. And interestingly, one of the biggest doctrines that we're focused on for the next few hundred years was the Sabbath and the changes in the Sabbath. I want to give you a quote. The problem with looking at the history of Sabbath keepers down through history is they're hard to find. A lot of it, not much is recorded, particularly from around 100 A.D. to around 300 A.D. You don't find a lot of history. You have to really search to find much about Sabbath keeping. But by around 300 A.D., a form of Christianity had begun to spread through the Roman Empire. But it looked very different in many respects from the Christianity that was taught by Christ and the apostles in the first century. I want to read here what an historian, Eusebius, he recorded a letter from the Emperor Constantine that was sent out after the Council of Nicaea meeting in 325 A.D. And it was regarding Sabbath-keeping Christians. And here's what this historian recorded, the letter from Constantine that was sent out. Forasmuch then, as it is no longer possible to bear with your pernicious errors, we give warning by this present statute that none of you henceforth presume to assemble yourselves together. We have directed, accordingly, that you be deprived of all the houses in which you are accustomed to hold your assemblies, and we forbid the holding of your superstitious and senseless meetings, not in public merely, but in any private house or place whatsoever. And then a little bit later he goes on to say, take the far better course of entering the Catholic Church. And so by the Council of Nicaea, it's kind of a turning point in history, because there'd been a lot of debate about how you should keep the Passover, keeping the Saturday Sabbath or maybe the Sunday Sabbath. There'd been a lot of debate. There'd kind of been two sides. But at this point was kind of the turning point. Of course, Constantine went on to basically accept the Christianity as the religion of the empires not long after the Council of Nicaea. But it gives you an idea of by that time, now here we're only talking about a couple of hundred years from the death of John. And we're at the point now where it's completely forbidden. It's senseless. As it's written here, superstitious. So what was going on here? Let's look at Revelation 2 and verse 10. This is a message to the Smyrna church. It says, "Do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life." Now, if we go by a day for a year that's applied so often in prophecy, then these 10 days would represent 10 years. Around 300 A.D., this was a little before the Council of Nicaea, the Emperor Diocletian had a big reign of persecution of Sabbath keepers, not just Christians, but Jews also. And this lasted about 10 years. And then for the 10 years after the Council of Nicaea, there was another 10-year period of persecution of Sabbath-keeping Christians. And so probably referring to the one that to Constantine, but it could be referring to one or the other. But we look at some other prophecies here. For example, going back to one of the blessing and cursings chapter, Leviticus 26, verse 18. After describing the blessings and the cursings and the repeated warnings, if you don't obey, this will happen. If you don't obey, this will happen. And eventually, in verse 18, the prophecy is, "And after all this, if you do not obey me, then I will punish you 7 times more for your sins." And so this is viewed as a prophecy, and again, a day for a year, times representing a year. So 7 times would represent 7 years, times 360 days would be 2,520 years. And if we look at from the fall of Judah, which is around 721, and go up to 2,500 years, we come up to around the beginning of the 1800s. And so that's a long time of, you might say, no blessings and persecutions. And there was heavy persecutions of Sabbath keepers in particular, right on through until around the 1800s, things began to change. That was the period when Britain and the United States began to flourish, began to grow in the 1800s. The blessings promised to Abraham of that great nation, a company of nations, began to come to fruition. There was more of a religious freedom attitude, certainly in the West, in the Western nations. And so there were some changes that happened at that time, and some of the curses eased off of those who were Sabbath keepers. If we look at Revelation 12 and verse 6, "Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God that she should feed, that they should feed her there for 1,260 days. Well, 1,260 days, basically, of in tribulation, hiding, being suppressed. If we look at that from the viewpoint of when basically the Council of Nicaea in 325, 1,260 days gets us up to around the beginning of 1600, not quite near 1600, but up around that time. Around 1600 to 1800 is often called in Europe the Age of Enlightenment, because it's a period of, was viewed through history lenses, as a period of enlightenment. There was more religious freedom. The Reformation had occurred, was going on during that time. More religious freedom, more tolerance, and things of this nature happened. And so there was a change at that time. So this prophecy could well relate to what was going on at that time. But let's go back and look at a little bit of the history between around the aftermath of the Council of Nicaea on up into the 1600s. What was going on with Sabbath keepers? Well, around 650 A.D., and it's hard to find some, the history doesn't like to record their massacres and their persecutions. It doesn't look good to write these things down, so you have to look to find them, but there's evidence that has been found that there were Sabbath keepers in Armenia, in Eastern Europe. Over the following centuries, Sabbath keepers spread out to various places in Europe, Bohemia, Poland, Germany, Italy, France, and England. And so Sabbath keepers were gradually spreading out through the European continent, kind of from east to west, eventually ending up in England. And that's about the only way you can trace the true church, is to look at, in history, where were the Sabbath keepers? You know, that's the identifying sign. And so there's evidence of that. Around 1000 A.D., numerous congregations arose up in the Alpine areas of Europe, you know, the Alps. The Alps kind of involve a number of countries there in Central Europe. And in that general area, quite a few congregations rose up. And let me give you this quote. This was in 1100s A.D. This was a Lutheran historian. And here's what he had to say. He said, there were those who held a notion that the observance of the law of Moses in everything except the offerings of sacrifices was obligatory upon Christians. They abstained from those meats, the use of which was prohibited under the Mosaic economy. And they celebrated the Jewish Sabbath. The second tenet which distinguished this sect was advanced in the opposition to the doctrine of three persons in the divine nature. Kind of sounds like the true church of God there, doesn't it? And so there was a flourish of Sabbath keeping. It centered around what historians have referred to as the Waldensians. It's from the late 1100s through the mid-1500s. Let me give you another historical reference here in terms of keeping the Sabbath. A scholar of that time, De Ketzer, wrote, the spread of heresy at this time is almost incredible. From Bulgaria to Ebro, from northern France to the Tiber, everywhere we meet them, whole countries are infested. Like Hungary and southern France, they abound in many other countries, in Germany, in Italy, in the Netherlands, and even in England, they put their efforts. Now, this was all in reference to Sabbath keepers, which is kind of interesting, what they're referred to, an infestation. You probably never thought of yourselves as being an infestation, did you? Well, what is he talking about here? You know, as I mentioned earlier, looking at the map here, Albania was down in this area here, but a lot of these countries, Bulgaria over in this area, on up to Hungary, Poland, on into Germany, France and Italy, and across to England. You know, it's kind of a movement spreading in that direction of Christians keeping the Sabbath. And during this period, this is a map of what things looked like in Europe around 1500, which was kind of at the point where the Waldensians began to be very heavily persecuted. And let's look a little bit about what was going on to give you a flavor of the types of persecutions true Christians were suffering during that period from about 1100 to 1500. 1184, the Synod of Verona, that was Pope Lucius III. The Waldensians were excommunicated from the church. In 1215, the Fourth Lateran Council, Pope Innocent III, denounced them as heretics. Don't you love the names of some of these popes? In 1487, Pope Innocent VIII ordered their extermination. Well, that's what you do with an infestation, right? You exterminate it. And that's what the Catholic Church was doing to true Christians during this time in Central Europe. By the mid-1500s, most that were left had joined the Protestant Reformation, and many of those that did not were massacred. And so this was a mini Holocaust of true Christians that occurred during this period, particularly as we got up closer and closer to around the mid-1500s. But then again, around 1600, things kind of changed. The Reformation started. That was not particularly significant in terms of the true church, but it did lead to more religious freedoms. And so you know from history that Mr. Franks gave a sermon a few years back that I think was played here, tracing the true church from Pilgrim's times on into the Northeast area, where he was a pastor in Boston. He did a lot of research there, and he gave us a good summary of what he had learned from the history that was he could find in museums and so forth up there. But it continued to spread. But it's hard to find where the true church is, but it is a sign of the true church. Now let's go back to my flowchart here. We talked about the Sabbath. I want to talk about two other covenants today. The first one is the Davidic covenant. Again, the Davidic covenant is a sub covenant of the Old Covenant, the Mosaic covenant. But let's look at that, and let's look at the agreement. The covenant was made, and it's described in 2 Samuel 7, beginning in verse 9. Now, as leading up to this that I'm to read here, David wanted to build a temple, wanted to build a house for God. And at first, Nathan the prophet said, yeah, go ahead. But then that night, God spoke to Nathan and said, well, hold on. Hold your horses just a minute here. And he gave Nathan some specific instructions to tell David. One of them was, well, he's not going to build his house, the house for God, because his hands are too bloody. But he said his son would. But he also said these other things, and that's where I want to pick up here in verse 9 of 2 Samuel 7. And I've been with you wherever you have gone, and have cut off all your enemies from before you, and have made you a great name, like the name of the great men who are on the earth. Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own, and move no more, nor shall the sons of wickedness oppose them any more, as previously, since the time that I commanded the judges to be over the people, my people Israel, and have caused you to rest from all your enemies. Also the Lord tells you that he will make you a house. And so here's the beginning of this covenant with David. It is basically a continuation of the Abrahamic covenant, because he is, again, promising his descendants will come back to Israel, have that land, and it'll be an everlasting inheritance to Abraham's descendants, which in turn is David's descendants. And so so he basically reaffirms the Abrahamic covenant, but that won't be fulfilled to Christ's second coming, when truly Israel will dwell in peace. But he continues on here, verse 12. When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I removed from before you. and your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever." Now, obviously, then, he is extending the scepter promise through David's line. And this also repeated, this whole covenant arrangement is also repeated in 1 Chronicles 17, verses 11 through 14. And then he's referring to David's son, so he's talking about Solomon. This will go on to Solomon. And Solomon will continue this line. Now let's look over at a few other scriptures related to this. Psalm 89, verse 20. "I have found my servant David, with my holy oil I have anointed him." And then verses 28 and 29 of Psalm 89. "My mercy I will keep for him forever, and my covenant shall stand firm with him. His seed also I will make to endure forever, and his thrones as the days of heaven." So again, this is unconditional. Just like the Abrahamic covenant is unconditional, so indeed is the covenant with David. Look at Jeremiah 33, verses 20 and 21. "Thus says the Lord, if you can break my covenant with the day and my covenant with the night, so that there will be not be a day and a night in their season, then my covenant may also be broken with David, my servant, so that he shall not have a son to reign on his throne, and with the Levites, the priests, and my ministers." So he said, here's what it'll take to break my covenant with David. The universe is destroyed. There'll be no sun, no moon, nothing. That's how strong God was trying to express to the people of that age what the covenant with David actually meant. We go over to Acts 2 in verse 29, the New Testament, and Peter is speaking on the day of Pentecost. That inspired sermon. "Men and brethren, let me speak freely to you of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Therefore, being a prophet, and knowing that God has sworn with an oath to him that of the fruit of his body, according to the flesh, he would raise up the Christ to sit on his throne, he, foreseeing this, spoke concerning the resurrection of Christ, that his soul was not left in Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus God has raised up, of which we are all witnesses." So here's a verification that this came down through the line of David, and a re-emphasis on God's commitment to the Davidic covenant. Continuing on in verse 33 of Acts 2. "Therefore, being exalted to the right hand of God, and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he poured out this which you now see and hear. For David did not ascend into the heavens, but he says himself, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand, till I make your enemies your footstool.' Therefore, let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ." So again, reemphasizing a partial fulfillment of the Davidic covenant came. Now, when David had a rough time when he first became king, a lot of the tribes of Israel weren't too enthusiastic about David as king. And so there was some resistance there. And eventually, the whole nation of Israel came around. He became king of the whole nation. And then God granted him victory over the many enemies of surrounding countries. And the nation of Israel began to expand. At its height, David's kingdom probably extended to about what you see here, from up around the Greece-Turkey borders, up in that area, all the way down to Sinai and Egypt. And, basically, pretty much half of the Fertile Crescent is how far it extended. So, David was greatly blessed. There was peace in his time. And then David died, Solomon took over. And God said, okay, those promises I will extend to your son, Solomon. And so that brings us to the next covenant, the Solomonic covenant. Let's look at that one. Now, after, you know, David didn't build the temple, but he gathered everything he could, used his wealth to get everything ready to build the temple, and then Solomon built it after he began to reign. And so the temple was built. You recall there was a great dedication to the temple. Solomon prayed during that point, asked for wisdom, and then God spoke to Solomon. And let's pick that up in 1 Kings 9, beginning in verse 3. And so this was God speaking to Solomon after the dedication of the temple. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication that you have made before me. I have sanctified this house which you have built to put my name there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. Now notice he says his eyes and his heart will be there perpetually. He doesn't say the temple will be there perpetually. Now if you walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and in uprightness, to do according to all that I have commanded you, and if you keep my statutes, my judgments, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, as I have promised David your father, saying, you shall not fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. And so, basically, what's going on here? You know, he is making this, essentially the same covenant with Solomon that he made with David. Which isn't fair enough. It's a conditional covenant. Let's continue on in verse 6 of 1 Kings 9. But, there's always that but. But if you or your sons at all, and notice now it's extending to his sons, his descendants, if you or your sons at all turn away and forsake my statutes, my commandments from following me, and do not keep my commandments and my statutes which I have set before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them, and this house which I have sanctified for my name I will cast out of my sight. Israel will be a proverb and a byword among all the people. Okay, a blessing, cursing. That was the covenant. And of course, you know what happened. You know, Solomon asked for wisdom. God gave him wisdom, and he gave him genius. One of the most brilliant individuals ever to walk the face of the earth was Solomon. And so he gave him wealth in addition to that. But then Solomon couldn't handle it. And so he turned away from God, turned to idols. How could you turn to idols after having spoken with God? But he did. He turned to idol worship, and the result then is that God again appears to Solomon, and therefore the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenants and my statutes which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David. God's still remembering the Davidic covenant here. But I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. So, the Solomonic covenant didn't last very long. It lasted through the rule of Solomon. It didn't affect the Abrahamic covenant. It didn't affect the Davidic covenant. But did it affect the scepter promise through Solomon? Or another question, what would have happened if Solomon had obeyed and kept the covenant? You know, it's fun sometimes to kind of think, what if Solomon had been like his father David and had kept the covenant? What do you think would have happened? If you remember the sermons I gave on Tyre, which involved the kingdom during the period of Solomon, Solomon had fantastic wealth. His kingdom, in combination with the navy of Tyre, and the trading of capability of Tyre, expanded from Gibraltar all the way over to the Persian Gulf. What would have happened if Solomon had obeyed? What would have happened to that? You saw the map of what David's empire looked like. How much more would the empire of Solomon have grown if he had followed the covenant that God initiated with him? Would we have been looking at the Israel Holy Empire instead of the Holy Roman Empire? You know, what would have happened? You know, here's a point in history. You know, two divergent paths. You know, the wrong path was taken. But think about what might have happened had Solomon has been as loyal to God as David had. And let's carry that a little further. What would have happened if after Solomon's death, if he had gone the route of keeping the covenant? Well, we don't know. But we can speculate a little bit here. And so I'll speculate. And I would suggest if Solomon had kept the covenant and died, and then when his son took over, I suspect that God would have come to his son like he did to Solomon and said, I had a covenant with your grandfather, I had a covenant with your father, and I'm willing to make a covenant with you. If you follow my laws, keep my commandments, I will bless you like I blessed your father and your grandfather. And if he did, God would have probably gone to his son and continued that on. But of course that didn't happen. The string was broken with Solomon, and so there were no further covenants made as a result. But what about the scepter promise through Solomon? Let's look at that. There's two genealogies of Christ in the New Testament. One of them is found in Luke, and the other is found in Matthew. There's also some genealogies in the Old Testament that take us from Adam right up through the kings of Israel and so forth. So there's a lot of genealogies floating around in the Bible. But I want to look at the Solomonic covenant, I want to look at the two genealogies in the New Testament, the genealogies that lead to Jesus Christ. In Luke, it goes from chapter of Luke 3 is from verses 23 to 38 is the genealogy. I want to show here just the first and the last verse of that genealogy. The first verse: Now Jesus himself began his ministry at about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, the son of Heli. And then it goes on and shows the son of, the son of, the son of, the son of, and it goes down and the end. Verse 38, the son of Enos, the son of Seth, the son of Adam, the son of God. All right, so this is traced all the way back to Adam. And so it's a reverse genealogy in the sense that it starts with Joseph's father, or Christ's father, and Joseph, and goes all the way back to Adam. Now, there is an issue here about whose genealogy this really is. And various scholars have looked at it, and the majority agree that this is the genealogy of Mary. This is Mary's genealogy. This phrase here, this from the son of Joseph, then the phrase the son of Heli. The son in the phrase the son of Heli is in italics, which means it wasn't in the original. And most scholars in the church accepts this too, is that this really is should read the son-in-law of Heli. In other words, that this is the genealogy from Mary's line, but you don't do genealogies with women. You do it with the fathers, not the mothers. And so to keep it in that format, it starts with Joseph, even though he is not the biological father of Jesus Christ. Mary is. So it is believed by most commentators that this is the biological genealogy of Jesus Christ, going all the way back to Adam. Now, so that's one genealogy. Like I say, it's likely Mary's genealogy or Christ's biological genealogy. Then there's the genealogy in Matthew 1. It goes from verses 2 to verse 16. Verse 2 of Matthew 1 begins, Abraham begot Isaac, Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob begot Judah and his brothers. So this genealogy goes forward, as opposed to the one in Luke going backwards. It begins with Adam, and then it ends with Jacob begot Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called the Christ. And so it appears then that the Matthew genealogy is not biological, but rather is the, it serves two things. Since genealogies go through the father's lines, this is, you might say, a legal genealogy because it's through the father. At the same time, it's also the royal lineage. Because when we look, we'll look in just a moment at the genealogy itself. The genealogy in Matthew 1 goes through all the kings of Judah. So this is also expressing the royal lineage of ancient Israel. All right, so let's look at that. We'll look at Joseph's lineage first. It goes from David to Solomon to Rehoboam to Abijah to Asa, Jehoshaphat, Joram or Jehoram. And this is another problem. Different books use different names for these kings. And so you have to always kind of be, well, which one's which? And sometimes there's one's the same name for a king of Israel as a king of Judah. And so it can get kind of confusing. So I put in parentheses the alternative names that are found, just to kind of keep it a little bit clear. And then Uzziah, Jotham. But did you notice there's something missing here in this genealogy? There's something missing. What's missing? That's missing. Four people are missing from that genealogy. Now, we could only speculate about why they're missing. But certainly the speculation might center around the fact that that period of those four people was a dark, dark time in the history of Judah. It was bad during that time. Now, another thing about people who studied genealogies back in that era, find that it's not unusual that people are skipped in genealogies. It's not like it would be today where everything has to be precise. It would not be that unusual to skip some names in a genealogy at that time. But we look at these four. Joram married Athaliah, just to give you a little background in case you've forgotten. We talked about this back when I covered the history of the kings of Judah and the lessons we could learn from them. Joram married Athaliah. Who was Athaliah? A daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. When Joram died, their son, Athaliah and Joram's son, Ahaziah, became the king. Athaliah had made sure of that by killing all the other heirs. And then Ahaziah did not last too long. And so Athaliah became queen. Unbeknownst to Athaliah, the priest had hidden the youngest of Joram's sons. It was a baby, Joash. They had hidden it and raised it in the temple. And Athaliah never knew about it. For 6 years, they hid the baby, which was an heir to the throne. And then when he was around 6 years old, the priest ordered Athaliah killed, and Joash assumed the throne. And he was working out pretty good as long as he was kind of following the leadership of the chief priest. But then he went his own way, and he went bad. His son Amaziah was pretty bad. And then from Amaziah we get to Uzziah. And so it may be that because of this dark age, you might say, that they were left out. But we don't know exactly why. But in any case, let's continue on with the lineage here, from Jotham to Ahaz, to Hezekiah, to Manasseh, to Ammon, to Josiah, to Jeconiah. And Jeconiah has three different names in the Bible. In Jeremiah is Coniah, and in other places is Jehoiachin, because his name was changed at the time of the fall of Jerusalem and so forth, when all these last kings were carted off and killed and that sort of thing. But again, something's missing here. You can always tell something's missing when there's a gap. So you can see there's a gap there. So obviously there's something missing here. What's missing? Well, in verse 11 of Matthew 1, it says, Josiah begat Jeconiah and his brothers about the time that they were carried away to Babylon. So now we're in the last 20 years or so of the life of Judah, of the life of Jerusalem, of the life of the temple. A very chaotic time. And during that time, there were three brothers of Jeconiah, or Jehoiachin, as is generally referred to in Kings, at least, and in Chronicles. But the three brothers were Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, and Zedekiah. Now, all three of them were kings of Judah. So what happened? Okay, well, of these other three sons of Josiah, Jehoahaz only reigned 3 months. And at that time, remember, this was a chaotic time. The Pharaoh, Egypt, was pushing from the south. Nebuchadnezzar was pushing from the north. The Philistines were uprising. Moab was uprising. Everybody wanted a piece of Judah. It was a very chaotic time. And so Jehoahaz only reigned for 3 months. And Necho, who was the Pharaoh of Egypt at that time, and was the prime, was, you know, Judah was basically subservient to Egypt. And so Necho had him replaced with Jehoiakim. And so Jehoiakim reigned for 11 years. Now, by that time, Nebuchadnezzar was on board here. And so Jehoiakim was carried to Babylon, and Jehoiachin, or Jeconiah, was reigned, and he only reigned for 3 months. And then Zedekiah was made king, and he was the last king, and he was just a titular head. He didn't really control anything much, but he was the last official king of Judah, and he reigned 11 years before he was carried off at the final collapse of Jerusalem, collapse of the temple, the destruction of the city, the destruction of the temple. He was carried off, blinded. All of his male heirs were killed, but his daughters were not. And they survived. And we believe, as I've mentioned before, that they were in Egypt for a while with Jeremiah, and they worked their way around eventually to Ireland and were considered princes. Princesses. in Ireland and led to the lineage that went through the King of England and some of these European countries as well. So that was kind of the lineage of Zedekiah, but what about Jeconiah? The one that's listed here in the you might say the royal lineage, Joseph lineage, in this one. Well, to answer that, let's go a little bit further here, because in verses 9 through 11, from Jeconiah it goes to Shealtiel and to Zerubbabel. So it continues. And we see, and we bring up the scripture, this is verse 12. And after they were brought to Babylon, Jeconiah begot Shealtiel, and Shealtiel begot Zerubbabel. Now, who was Zerubbabel? Zerubbabel was goes to the time of Ezra and Nehemiah and the exiles coming back from Babylon to Israel, to Judah, to Jerusalem, to rebuild the temple. Okay, Ezra and Nehemiah came back to rebuild the temple. Zerubbabel was sent back by the Persians to be governor of the district. And so he was governor of the district. So he played a role in the rebuilding of the temple. All right, so at that point, I'm going to stop here on the Joseph line for a minute, and let's go look at Mary's line. Okay, this is Luke 23 through 31, and this is the line. And let's begin with David. And look who comes next after David, Nathan. What happened to Solomon? Don't see a Solomon in this list, do you? You know, we see David, Nathan, and it goes on down the line. And there's another interesting thing here. If we look over in that third column here, we see Nerai to Shealtiel to Zerubbabel. So here's Zerubbabel pops up in both these lineages. What's going on here? Now, well, first, let's talk about why Solomon's not in the biological lineage to Jesus Christ. We go back to 1 Chronicles 3 and verse 5. And these were born to him, referring to David, in Jerusalem, Shemaiah, Shobab, Nathan, and Solomon, four by Bathsheba, the daughter of Immiel. So Nathan was a brother of Solomon. The biological line from David to Jesus Christ went through Nathan, not Solomon. So when Solomon fell from grace, you might say, God not only removed him, he removed him from the biological line to Jesus Christ himself. Didn't remove David, but he removes Solomon from that line. So the lineage did not go through Solomon. It went through Nathan, his brother. Now, the kings of Judah were also descendants of David and Solomon. And that was, you might say, the royal line. So let's go back and look at that. I want to go back to Matthew, the royal line genealogy. Jeconiah goes from Jeconiah, his son Shealtiel, Zerubbabel, and then Abiud. That's the line that we read in Matthew 1. In Luke 3, we read a different line. Nerai, Shealtiel, Zerubbabel, Risa. What's going on here? What's happening? Zerubbabel and Shealtiel appear in both of these lineages. How does that happen? How does that work? Well, the answer is, I don't know. And the answer is also, so does nobody else knows either. Nobody's been able to quite figure out what this actually means. A lot of scholars have racked their minds over what this means, and they've come up with various theories. But none of them seem to quite work right. So I'll suggest a possibility of what's going on here. But let's look at Matthew 1:11, and we looked at this a while ago. Josiah begat Jeconiah, through Jehoiakim, and his brothers about the time they were carried away into Babylon. So like I say, that last 20 years of the history of Jerusalem was a very chaotic time. Now, if we look at 1 Chronicles 3:15, we see the sons of Josiah were Johanan, the firstborn, the second, Jehoiakim, the third, Zedekiah, and the fourth, Shalom. And so these were the four sons. Okay, now, it appears that maybe Johanan must have died early. He's never mentioned anywhere else. But the other three became kings for some a very short period of time. And then if we look at 1 Chronicles 3:16, we see the sons of Jehoiakim were Jeconiah, his son, and Zedekiah, his son. All right, so we see that, again, Jehoiakim or Jeconiah or Coniah. Again, these names, they keep changing all these names on us, so it's hard to keep track. but we see then that, so what was going on was that, first of all, Jeconiah was carried away to Babylon probably around 597 B.C. There were several waves when Nebuchadnezzar came in, took a lot of spoils, took a lot of the princes, took the kings of Israel, and took them to Babylon in that early wave in around 597 B.C. And so Jeconiah was carried away then. Zedekiah was the last king. And he was taken to Babylon in 586 when the city actually fell and the temple was destroyed. And as I mentioned, Zedekiah was blinded. His sons were all killed, leaving no sons but some daughters. But Jeconiah, interestingly enough, lived many years in Babylon. He was in prison for a number of years, but after Nebuchadnezzar's death, he was released from Babylon, from prison in Babylon. And the Bible records this, that he was released and lived for a while, and was taken care of by the king of Babylon. But now, in looking at the lineage here, let me go to Jeremiah. Well, let's see. I want to go. Oops, let's go back here first. I went a step too far. So let's look at what we have here. We have Josiah. We have four sons: Johanan, Jehoiakim, Zedekiah, and Jehoahaz. all became kings, and then Jehoiakim's son was Jeconiah. He was hauled off to Babylon, spent years in prison there. And then, according to, he had a number of sons, but two of them were Pedaiah and Shealtiel, according to the lineage we saw in Matthew. And then we see, put in red here, the Neri to Shealtiel and Zerubbabel. Is the other option. So you can see there's something's going on here. And so most scholars who study this speculate that what is likely to have happened is that since this is a chaotic time, people were getting, you know, people were getting killed, children were getting killed, parents were getting killed, people starving to death, and there were various sieges of Jerusalem that lasted some time for years. When people were hauled off, they were hauled back to Babylon. Now, being hauled off to Babylon is not being hauled off to Baton Rouge, like being hauled off to Baton Rouge. It's like months' journey to go from Jerusalem to Babylon. You know, I think it took 3 months for the exiles to come back when they came back from Babylon to rebuild the temple. You know, they're prisoners of war. It's probably not the most pleasant trip. They're probably not taken care of very well. So there's lots of death, lots of destruction. The royal family being nearly destroyed is what the bottom line comes down to. And so the speculation is among scholars is that what happened was, remember in ancient Israel, there was a law about inheritances and so forth, and then if a man died without an heir, without a son, a brother was obligated to marry the widow of this man, produce a son, and that son would take the name of the dead brother, not the actual father. You know, there was that kind of thing. So they think that might have been going on then, but I'm not sure that's the case, but I'm not convinced. The arguments are a little weak, I think, in certain areas. But more than likely, there was a lot of adoption going on. Parents were killed, uncles were killed, so forth, and people were taking other members of the family in and basically raising them as their own children. And I suspect that that's probably why we have this line that's shown here. And it could well be that through Zerubbabel, since there's two lines that go out from Zerubbabel, one in Matthew 1 and one in Luke 3, two different lines come from Zerubbabel, that it's more than likely that one of those was probably adopted. One line was probably through adopted sons as opposed to actual sons. One thing we know for sure, because the Bible says so, and that's found over in Jeremiah 22, verses 28 through 30. Is this man, Kaniah, which is referring to Jeconiah, a despised, broken idol? Is he a vessel in which there's no pleasure? Why are they cast out, he and his descendants, and cast into a land which they do not know? O earth, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, write this man down as childless, a man who shall not prosper in his day, for none of his descendants shall prosper sitting on the throne of David and ruling any more in Judah. Okay, so let's go back to that flow chart one more time. And so what we're saying here then, or what that's saying is the line of rulers of Israel does not go through Jeconiah. And as far as we can determine, they went through Zedekiah as far as physical rules. But it certainly wouldn't go through to Jesus Christ, the ultimate ruler. And so it must have been some kind of family adoptions or marriage kind of things to replace a widowed who didn't have a son and so forth. Whatever it is, we don't know for sure, but we do know it couldn't have been through Jeconiah. So more than likely, Neri the Shealtiel to Zerubbabel is the actual lineage that goes to Christ. And of course, it continues on from Zerubbabel. You know, so kind of confusing, but it's interesting to see how all this is working out in terms of fulfillment of these covenants that Christ made with David and made with Solomon, which Solomon broke. Which brings me then to my last slide, and this is what we've covered so far in the last three sermons on the covenants. The Adamic, the Noetian, the Abrahamic, the Judaic, the Old Covenant, the Sabbath Covenant, the Davidic, the Solomonic, and the Ezraic covenants. We've covered all that. So what's left? What's left? You may think that there's still one left. You may be surprised, and you'll find out next time I speak.